So this is Dirk, and this is a survivor of ritual abuse and sexual abuse. He's a psychotherapist, and he specializes in trauma resolution with clients that have dealt with a range of trauma, including ritual abuse and other types of experiences. So I will turn it over to you.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just want to start by saying how happy I am to be here. This is only my second RAA conference, although I spent years in a SIA group in Washington, D.C. that focused on RAA. So I've had lots of experience talking to others about my experience and theirs. But I didn't know about SMART or survivorship until a couple years ago. So 2.5 years ago, I went to SMART. I found it very helpful. I determined to go back the next year, and when Neil asked for volunteers to do presentations, I volunteered to present at the Clinicians Conf day. And then, 10 days before the conference, I fell off a bike and severely broke a leg. I was in hospital for 2 weeks just to get... So I had to call him and say, sorry, I'm not going to be there. And then last summer, I was going to go, but a unchangeable family event came up. So I started thinking, maybe I've got to go to survivorship. So in January, I started to register, and I was talking to Shamaya online and telling her about all this, and she said, well, you want to do a presentation? I said, I'll think about it. And a couple days later, I said, yeah, I'll do it. Set it all up. February 1st, dark, cold night. Went out to sweat ice and all on my sidewalk. Another broken leg.
Wow.
But I've had time to recover enough to be here, so I'm very glad that I could be here at this point. What I'm going to do today is interweave stuff I want to teach you, if I maybe, and my own experience. So let's start with part of my story. This will give you the big context. The pieces I'm going to read to you are things that I've started writing. I'm starting to think about writing a memoir, and if I ever get to it, these will be pieces of the memoir. As long as I can remember, I feared my father. Even when I loved him, I feared him. For over 40 years of my life, I didn't understand why. Then it came clear as I remembered my early childhood. What I know now is that I experienced abuse in the early years of my life. In my late 40s, I recovered memories of that abuse. The first memories I got involved sexual abuse at the hands of an uncle, my mother's brother. Then memories of ritual abuse started to emerge, and after some time it became clear that my father was at the center of those memories. But that was all a very gradual process over a number of years. So I didn't remember all of that for most of my childhood and youth. The abuse had occurred in a small farming community in northwest Iowa, where my parents grew up and where I lived for the first 5 years of my life. Then halfway through my sixth year of life, we moved from there to western Michigan. My father had decided to quit farming and become a clergyman. That took me away from the abuse. I also now believe that it was the way that my father managed to escape the cult that he had become involved in at some point in his younger life. For me, it meant the abuse stopped and my life took on a semblance of normalcy. But the terror didn't go away. It kept surfacing on and off for the next 40 years until circumstances led me to the place where I could remember what happened. In the meantime, I acted, as many of us do, as if nothing had happened. I did well in school, excelled in music, was the star of my family. All through high school and college, I was a leader and an honor student. But I never really felt good about my accomplishments and my core self. And then looking back, I never felt safe in the world. After college, despite the fact that I am quite clear, and was then, that I am a gay man, I did what a lot of gay men of my generation did, and married a woman and had 2 children. And I followed my father's path and became a clergyman. I had a 20-year career as a priest in the Episcopal Church. Much of it was good. But still, something was wrong. I was living a lie, and underneath that lie was the terror and a whole lot of dissociation. Then the life I had so carefully constructed fell apart. In 1988, my wife ended the marriage. My career in the church was dead-ending as I failed to climb the ladder of success that I had envisioned. The terror inside got closer and closer to the surface, finally led me to the edge of sanity. For about a year in my life, I had daily attacks of anxiety and sometimes panic that just would not stop. At one point, I checked into a psychiatric hospital for 5 days, only to discover that they didn't have a clue of what to do with me. I went home to the terror and knew that I had to figure out what to do for myself. In that transitional period of my life, which lasted from about 1990 to 1996, my inner life was often chaotic. My memories gradually came to consciousness, and just about everything I knew and believed about my life changed. I will tell you stories about that process later, but the result is that I became a different person and my life took on different forms. I left my career in the church, I went back to school to become a psychotherapist, I started living my life as an openly gay man, and eventually met the man who is now my life partner. I've now had almost 20 years in the second part of my life, and I would not trade it for anything, despite the pain involved in the transition. I can't imagine going back to the life I used to live. I could wish that my new life hadn't come at the price of having to remember the abuse of my childhood, but I've accepted the truth that the only way through the pain is to embrace it and move into the future. Because of the particularities of my experience, the abuse in early childhood, followed by years of apparently normal childhood and youth, and the ways in which memories surface decades later, I've become fascinated by memory. How it works, how it fails us, how it can go underground and then emerge when conditions are favorable. And as a mental health professional, I've spent years educating myself in order to understand my experience and to assist others in the process of remembering and healing. Today I'm going to tell you what I've learned about memory, and then I will tell you more of my story. I will talk about the act of remembering. What you are remembering is terrifying. And I hope to make clear that this work is an act of courage, given all the forces that conspire together to keep us from remembering. Okay, so did you all get a handout? If not, back there on the table, on the chair in the room. First, let me tell you a little bit more about how I learned all this. When I went back to school in 1983 to become a therapist, I was just in the throes of just beginning my actual recovery. But over the next 3 years, I made a lot of strides. At one point in those 3 years, a fellow student was telling some of us about her experience with EMDR, and I was just blown away because it seemed to do amazing things for her. So in 96, after I became a licensed mental health professional, I trained in it as soon as possible. So I've now been doing it for over 16 years, and not a day goes by that I don't use it in my office, but I mix it up with a lot of other things. So doing that work, I became more and more involved in working with trauma survivors. So I studied more and more, and one summer I went to an institute with Bessel van der Kolk, and he said if you really want to do trauma work, pay attention to the work of Peter Levine and Pat Ogden. So you're shaking your heads, Awakening the Tiger. I eventually picked Pat's model because I really liked it. And starting in 10 years ago, I did about 6 years of intensive training with what's called the Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute. Changed my work and changed my life. It's really good stuff. And a lot of what I'm going to go into with you now comes from those years of training. So we'll go through some of this fast because there's a lot of material here. But if you have questions about it, I'll try to make time for that. And I'll stay as long as people want to talk afterwards. So let's start off with my basic premise. There's two quotes. Essentially, all models are wrong, but some are useful. Theories are not true or false. They are useful or not useful. So everything I'm going to tell you is not the God's truth. It's just the current state of our understanding of how our brains work, how they respond to trauma, and what happens in the recovery process. 5 years from now, it's going to be different. 25 years from now, it's going to be radically different. But these are useful models for today. Okay, neurons, or nerves, as we sometimes call them. What are they and what do they do? Turn the page. Neurons are amazing cells of the body that specialize in conveying and processing information. But information is a broad term there. Information includes things like emotions and all aspects of experience. If you look at all those, you just see how incredibly complex they are. I'm not going to spend any time on them. What I want you to just know is that every time one of those little branches ends, that's a place to connect to another neuron. And that place of connection is called a synapse. And what we believe now, although no one has sat there and gone through a human nervous system and counted every one, is that we've got about 100 billion neurons in our body. That's more than 10 times as many neurons as there are people on the face of the earth at this point. And that we have about 10 trillion, probably many more, synapses. I just checked this morning, the federal budget this year is $3.5 million, so you have 3 times as many synapses as there are dollars in your federal budget. That's why our brains are such incredibly complex organisms, and why they do such incredible things. Okay, so now, and one of the things they do, going back to the first page, is store the information that they convey and process in various forms. We'll get to that storage stuff later. So how are these neurons organized? Anyone familiar with Daniel Siegel's work, The Developing Mind, Parenting from the Inside Out, psychiatrist, neuroscience at UCLA? He's got this great model. I teach it to everybody. If you were to try to take those 100 billion neurons and divide them into sections, you could understand it this way. This is all those 100 billion neurons. Everything in the arm are the neurons that run through out the body from the neck down. We call that the sensory motor division because they contain sensory nerves that bring information, motor nerves that send out commands to the body. And that's what we study in the sensory motor psychotherapy institute in many ways, but I'm not going to go into that more. Okay, then where my wrist is where all those nerves come into the brain, to the skull, right at the back of the skull, at the neck. That's where your brain stem is. That is a very primitive part of our brains. Something like a brain stem goes all the way back through evolutionary history, even to simple multi-cell organization. Your brain stem is all about your survival and the survival of the species. It keeps your heart beating, keeps your breathing, keeps your body temperature up. It tells you when you're hungry, and because it's about the survival of the species, it's where a lot of our sexual drives come from. Very primitive. Yeah, farther up inside the skull, in the center, where my thumb is a section we call the midbrain or the limbic area. The limbic area is actually a very complex set of parts, but to keep it simple, there are 2 parts there that are very important. One is the hippocampus, and that's important because it's the kind of center for memory. It's now considered to be the map maker that keeps track of where all the pieces of memory are scattered throughout the brain. We'll say more about that later. And then the amygdala is in the limbic area, and that's the alarm center of the brain. When you get triggered, it's likely because your amygdala has noticed something that it associates with danger. And it says, sit up and take attention, pay attention, folks, there's danger here. So those are 2 most important parts of the limbic area. In general, the limbic area is considered the seat of most emotions. A lot of our emotional impulses come from there. And since a lot of our emotions come from our interactions with our environment and with people, it's sort of the part of the brain that's interested in connectivity with the outside world. All right, then wrapped around that, like my fingers, are the cortexes, those wrinkly things you see when you see a picture of the brain. And those are the most recent part of evolutionary development of the brain. Most mammals have them, primates have bigger ones, and we have the biggest ones of all. Okay? That's where we think. That's where we have cognition. That's where we have beliefs. Okay? Now, what's important about this model, that's what makes this model so useful, is that this developed hierarchically, and it functions hierarchically. Most of the time, we live with our frontal lobes, our neocortex, in charge. But when something happens that triggers the amygdala, the brain downshifts, and the amygdala, the midbrain, starts to take over. In sensory motor psychotherapy circles, we call that being hijacked. It's why so often we can find ourselves suddenly taken over by emotions and so find it so difficult to control those emotions. It's because suddenly the midbrain has taken charge of things. In the event of a real threat to life, we can downshift even further. The brainstem takes over and we go into survival mode. If you've ever experienced anything where you're totally numbed out and shut down, that's your brainstem running the show. It's the same thing that happens in physiological shock when you're injured. Most of your body shuts down and just goes into survival mode. This is the psychological equivalent of that kind of shock. Fortunately, we can also upshift, and there are techniques to use to get ourselves back up through that hierarchy. That's a lot of what therapy is about. I think people to be mindful about what's going on in their brain and to work with it, because we can create feedback loops from the upper brain down to the lower parts and say, so the amygdala, no, wait a minute, I'm looking around and I don't see any danger. Maybe there really isn't a problem here. And when we do that kind of work, things often start to calm down. Okay. Just a little side note, if any of you know the work of Stephen Porges, polyvagal theory, that I'm not going to talk about that, but it dovetails nicely with this because he has that hierarchy of three different systems in the vagus nerve, very similar to this. If you're interested, go online and look for Porges, P-O-R-G-E-S, polyvagal, V-A-G-A-L, theory. Fascinating stuff. Okay, let's take a break. Questions about what I've said so far? Is this making sense? Coming through? Okay, so now we're just going to keep adding layers of complexity here. So the next thing is number 3, 5 core organizers of experience. So our brain works in those various levels, but that's not how we experience life. We don't go around saying, oh, my neocortex is running the show right now. Oh, my amygdala has just gone off. Oh, I'm downshifting into my brainstem and I'm shutting down and going to a freeze state. We experience life in very different ways. And so Pat Ogden, who's head of the Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute, has this model that I find very useful. We experience life in all these different categories. She calls them the 5 core organizers of experience. First is 5 sense experience. We're probably most aware of that a lot of the time. So what we see, what we hear, what we taste, what we touch, what we smell, and what we touch just constantly flood our brain with information. And a lot of it we process, some of it just goes by unnoticed. If it's important, it gets stored in various cortexes, the visual cortex, the auditory cortex, all those different ones. But mostly, it comes through and we process it. That's called exteroception. Then there's what we call internal felt sensation, or interoception. When you notice that you got a cramp in your leg muscle, when you notice that your stomach is churning, when you notice that your heart's beating faster, when you notice that crink in your neck, when you notice a headache, that's all interoception. And that information is coming into the brain constantly. It's part of the body monitoring itself to make sure that your heart still is beating at the right rate. And those are separate nerves from the other nerves that do exteroception. Okay, now here's the really complicated one, emotions and feelings. We experience life in various emotional states. Mostly we don't talk about how we know that is happening. But this is a very important concept I want to stress. We know how that is happening, how those emotions are happening, actually, because they're happening throughout our body. That churning in the stomach, that crink in the neck, that headache is often related to what's happening around us, to stressors. And that is, in fact, the midbrain's way of getting our attention. So if I have a gut-wrenching anxiety, that's my amygdala saying, sit up and pay attention. Now what I do is I translate that into thought, oh, I must be anxious about something, I must be scared. So that does involve the upper brain, but when the amygdala is starting to run an emotion, it's happening in your body. And that's what I spent 6 years studying with the Sensory Motor Center Therapy Institute. And if you really do it, you'll start noticing your own body, you might start noticing other bodies. So much of what's going on inside is actually visible on the outside. We learn to read facial expressions, read tension in people's bodies, if they're fidgeting. So a lot of my work consists of saying things like, so I'm noticing that you seem uncomfortable in the chair. What's going on right now? Or when you say you're angry at your friend, how does your body tell you that you're angry at your friend? Where is it? And if it's in the arms and neck, then that really confirms that it's anger. Then I might say, so if your arm, those muscles in your arm and neck could talk right now, what would they say? Because then when you start translating into words, it becomes clearer what's really going on. Because we live in a culture that trains us to ignore a lot of this stuff. We just, it's happening. We're taught not to fidget in school, especially boys. We're taught to just pretend as if everything's okay. And pretty soon, our brain starts actually ignoring all this important information. And so I see a big part of my job to teach people how to pay attention to that. Fourth core organizer, cognitions. As I said earlier, that's up in the upper brain. That's what we think about something, that's what we believe. Actually, a lot of our emotional responses are kind of shaped by what we believe about certain situations. That kind of sets us up to then have a strong emotional response. So these things are all interconnected. The brain is just one huge network, or I like to think of it as spider webs of neurons going off together at the same time. Information is flying everywhere in every direction, top to bottom, side to side, and it's just mind-boggling, and I find it fascinating. Finally, here's another really interesting idea. One of the core organizers are movement impulses. If you ever start paying attention to your body and ask it what it wants to do in a given moment, you'll learn a lot about what's going on emotionally and cognitively. I regularly, if I'm noticing someone's foot getting fidgety or saying, oh, what's going on there? And a little energy in the legs. And so we ask, what does that leg want to do? He wants to get out of here. So then what we do is say, go out the door and stand outside for 30 seconds and see what happens. The energy goes away. That's all it wanted. That's all the emotion wanted, to know that escape was possible. And then client can come back in, we can focus on the work without that getting in there. Okay, any questions about that model.
Is that separate from restless leg syndrome?
Yeah. Well, the restless leg syndrome may be a chronic thing that developed from years and years of anxiety.
So all that study of that things, have you guys come to any knowledge about why at such a young age the brain's able to split off into different personalities? And is there any knowledge about that?
Yeah, and we're going to talk about some ways of understanding that down at the bottom of the page, ways of understanding dissociation. Okay, now this is number four, right brain, left brain processing. This is probably something many of you have heard about. There's many ways of talking about this. I like to keep it really simple. Just to go back to the Siegel model, you know, it's not really this, it's this. You have two hemispheres. And there's a wonderful TED Talk. If you ever look at TED Talks, the woman who wrote the book My Stroke of Insight, She actually standing there and she goes and she picks up this brain, she goes and separates the two halves and they literally go like this. There's no connection up at the top. It is all down here in the midbrain and the brainstem. It's called the corpus callosum. So they can function as independent processing units in many ways, and then the information flows back and forth through the corpus callosum. So how do they differ? I just like a simple explanation. Left brain thinks in words, right brain thinks in pictures and other sensory information. However, this is really important when it comes to trauma, because we know that in the face of overwhelming experience, and this has been studied with brain scans, that various parts of the left brain often shut down. Bessel van der Kolk can show you brain scans where people's broken areas, which is the part of the left brain that forms words, shuts down when they're scared speechless. And in the face of overwhelming trauma, we also know that the hippocampus can shut down. So instead of integrating all the pieces of memory, the right brain stuff and the left brain stuff, what's left are fragments. And because it's fragments, it's never turned into a cohesive story, a narrative where you can say this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened. So that's one of the elements of why trauma is so difficult for people to process, because it's just a piece here, a piece there, a piece there. You with me? Questions? Okay, we're getting there. Five, short-term recall versus long-term memory. This is something I've never found a lot of good research on, but we do know that at the point at which the emotional component of trauma is processed, somehow it changes the way it's stored in the brain. In short-term recall, things are the memory is experienced as if it is happening again, like we're re-experiencing it. Probably many of you know what this is like. When it has been processed and the emotions have been made sense of, it goes into what we call long-term storage, and then it has an objectivity. The events feel like they are in the past. That's in my office. Those are the magic words. When I do EMDR and the client comes in the next week and says, you know, when I think about that now, it's in the past. I jump up and down and cheer. Because it really does happen. You see it happening before your eyes when you do trauma resolution work. Something shifts in memory and it no longer comes up and takes over. It no longer has the ability to hijack us and turn on our limbic system and make us re-experience it. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. So, we're going to talk about two different models for understanding dissociation. And these are just two of the many ways of understanding dissociation. let me start by saying, in response to the question, the way I sometimes explain brain functioning is to say that at any given moment, there's several million or billion neurons in your brain firing together at the same time. Like a big spider web. They're all lighting up at the same time. Next moment, it could be a completely different network. With memories, if the hippocampus has a map of where everything in the memory is, it can call it up, and this whole network comes together, and voila, we have a memory. All it takes is one missing synapse, one synapse that doesn't fire, and you can begin to get fragmentation. In repeated traumatic experience, the ability for those synapses not to fire just becomes more and more sophisticated in the brain. And once it's happened, dissociation becomes habitual around certain things. But then what forms that take are very different for every human being. We all dissociate in different ways. Because it's incredibly complex. So these two models are ways of thinking about that complexity. Page 3, Dissociative Phenomena. This comes from a book that I very highly recommend. I think it's 10, 12 years old now. I discovered it pretty soon after it came out. The Myth of Sanity by Martha Stout. Anyone familiar with it? Really good book. And very readable. It's written for the public. It's not a technical book. Subtitle is Divided Consciousness and the Promise of Awareness. She talks a lot about how dissociation works with a lot of clinical vignettes. Lots of stories of clients with multiplicity. It's very readable. I read the first two chapters, reread it on the plane out here just to refresh my memory. And I really love that book. So this is pretty much borrowed straight from one of the later chapters in the book. What I like about this model is that it helps make sense of how the extreme forms of dissociation that occur in multiplicity are not different in kind, they're just different in intensity. So it's, every human being associates every day of their lives at some level or another. And going down this list, particularly the first four, daydreaming, losing oneself in a story, book, or movie, pre-phasing, habitual dissociative reactions, being absent-minded. You know, almost every human being does that at one point or another. But as you go down the list, it gets more complicated. Probably most people have some dissociation from certain feeling states that they don't like. They'll say, oh, I don't like to feel that way. But the intrusion of dissociated ego states or flashbacks, that's more problematic. And then we get down to the demi-fugue, feeling absent from the self or from reality, sometimes called derealization or depersonalization. As you can see, we're going down this list, we're just getting to more and more intense levels of dissociation. More and more level, it's degrees at which the brain compartmentalizes. This International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation defines dissociation as the abilities of the brain to focus consciousness on one thing to the exclusion of other things. And that's all that's going on here. But when it gets to the point where it has done that habitually over and over and over again, is when it can become problematic for us. So that happens in traumatic amnesia, number 8, an ability to recall circumstances or details of traumatic experience. And then even more extreme fugue states are when people start losing time, they don't remember what happened for a period of time. She's got a great chapter in this book entitled When I Woke Up on Tuesday, It Was Friday. pretty good description of fugue states. And then finally, the extreme of dissociative identities, parts are accurate. Okay, questions about that?
You said that this all starts between you and because of a faulty neuron or whatever. And I always thought that it was because of a coping mechanism rather than something you're firing.
The synapse not firing is a coping mechanism. It's the brain's way of saying, I'm not going to go there.
Okay.
It's the mechanism by which that happens.
So it just shuts down then?
Yeah. Now, and what happens when we finally remember is that synapse, or all the necessary synapses to fire, finally make connection. And that involves neurotransmitters, that involves a whole bunch of biochemicals, very complex.
What's the difference between the two family members that
The luck of the genetic lottery, your individual experience, how much support you had at any given moment. Bessel van der Kolk will say one of the biggest correlatives of whether someone develops PTSD in the face of traumatic experiences, whether they were alone or whether they had support. In the event or soon thereafter.
Has there been any research on the effect of adrenaline on brain function?
Oh, yeah. The stuff with cortisol, all the adrenal chemicals, epinephrine, norepinephrine, cortisol. It's very complicated. I spent years trying to figure it out and I still don't understand it. But cortisol can. One of the things that gets regularly argued about is whether. People with PTSD have low levels of cortisol in their blood or not, and whether bad regulation of cortisol levels actually affects the size of the hippocampus. There's regulations on both. There's research on both sides of that issue. We're not going to spend time on that today.
What about how the synapses they turn off, and then you don't remember? Is it to a point to where you will never remember? Is there permanent damage from trauma?
That's
does that make sense? I mean,
yeah, it makes sense.
Because, well, for me, my perspective is that I still do not remember the majority of my childhood.
Well, there's two possibilities. Two possibilities is that the brain is so shut down that there is no memory trace.
Yeah.
And if it's early enough, the brain isn't making a record of most of the events of childhood anyway before 5. So trauma before 5 has to be really extreme. I'm going to talk about that because that's my experience. If there is a memory trace anywhere in the brain, I think the chances are good that sooner or later you're going to get to it. But it can take years. I'm going to talk about my experience of 10 years of detective work to kind of finally solidifying one piece of memory.
Yeah, I just don't remember. It's just not there, and I've always wondered, has it been so shut down because it's so traumatic from being an infant on that you cannot. It's a permanent dead zone, you know. And so to me, it sounds like it's just a permanent dead zone.
Yeah.
I have brain.
The hippocampus was completely shut down and wasn't making record of anything. Maybe that you were in. Pretty much in a freeze state, and so most of the brain was shut down. Just the brain stem is keeping you alive.
I didn't catch all of what you said about before the age of 5. Could you repeat that?
Most of us, even if we haven't had trauma, don't remember much before age 5. But some people do remember things before age 5 if they're really vivid memories. There's a great book about memory. Eric Kandel, K-A-N-D-E-L. 50 years of brain research for which he got a Nobel Prize in medicine and physiology in about 2000. He wrote this book, In Search of Memory. And it's all about this, how each of these things got discovered, either by him or other people. And at one point he's talking about this, and he says that if the emotional valence or strength of an event is strong enough, it can create an instant memory, a learning, without any repetitive review. A lot of things we have to keep going over and over and over again to remember. But if it's strong enough, the brain gets it, and the neural network that remembers it is in place forever. And when I read that, I said, oh my God, finally someone has explained my experience, because I have snapshot memories from age 2 and 3 that are completely out of context. But you know, for years I wondered, how could that be? And here's Eric Kandel saying, yes, it happens.
Is intuition mapped out in the brain at all?
No, not that I know of. Probably it's everywhere. A lot of the answer to a lot of these questions is it's not in one place, it's everywhere. Much of what is going on is the whole brain working. It's just that when we talk about, well, the hippocampus does this, or the amygdala does this, or the frontal cortex does this, that's sort of where the most important action is taking place at the moment. It's kind of the command center, it's running the show. But for the hippocampus to bring up a memory, it has to be lighting up the visual cortexes, the auditory cortexes, cognitions and beliefs about the event, and those are scattered all over the brain. Probably lighting up, if you have emotions attached to the memory, you can see the limbic area lighting up. It's just this whole big map just suddenly goes, and it's like from nothing you see the whole map of the world with certain things highlighted. Yeah.
About the person who's asking questions about memory, I'm also someone who remembers things from being extremely young, and have been looking on the history of RA, MC, etc. for about 17 years, and I have worked with Matt Danichuk, who's a SSPD person, and when she and I worked together, there are some things that she said that I found very useful, but there's still a lot of things I don't remember, was that because, and you was know about this, and I actually say something about this, about how memory, as we found, is not just stored in the brain, it's stored in the body.
That's a hot topic these days.
And how that if any amount, if memory is encoded at home, it would be theoretically accessible, so it's there somewhere, and you can get to it if it's there at all.
But the question is, are the synapses firing enough?
Yeah. Are the channels open for you to get to it?
Okay, good. We've got to watch time, so one more question.
But I like what you did say, that if there's even a little bit of trace, then the brain does have the capacity to create a new channel for that.
It can open up that wherever that is, that memory is stored. And
that's for the intuition question. Can Kurtz work on memories of emotion? Can Kurtz talks a lot. She talks about how our gut knows, and it's about intuition, but because our bodies, our memories are in our emotions.
Can you say the questions on the end? Because I'm hoping.
Real quick.
Okay.
How long can you stay in the energy state?
I think weeks, months.
Yeah.
It's more common for a couple of days, people. A common fugue state. Oh, you said demi-fugue. My experience of demi-fugue is that it usually lasts 24 to 48 hours, but that's only my experience. And it's pretty hard to get people to track it because it's so foggy.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Okay, real quickly, the last model, structural dissociation. This is, I just think this is an amazing model, and the fact that a lot of researchers use it now as a way to understand dissociation recommends it. I'm not going to go into it very deeply, but the important thing is on the first page to understand the difference between the emotional personality and the apparently normal personality. Right now I'm interacting with you with my apparently normal personality. And most of the time, that's the way I interact with the world. But if the right trigger comes along and one of my EPs comes to the fore, you see a very different person. Usually I get away from people as quickly as possible, see what I can deal with. But what I love about this model is that it allows you to see the escalating levels of complexity in dissociation. So in primary dissociation, simple trauma like a car accident, you've probably got an ANP and then AP that holds the memories of the car accident. And if that can be processed, the dissociation is pretty much taken care of. For more chronic ongoing trauma, you're more likely to be in secondary dissociation with a number of EPs that may have certain emotion states, focus on emotion states. And then when it gets so difficult that you need more than one apparently normal personality to cope with life, that's when you start getting multiplicity. So that's all I'm going to say about that, but I think it's a useful way of understanding that multiplicity is tied into this continuum. And it's just the result of the level of intensity that you were talking about. Okay. All right, now what I would like to do is read to you two pieces about my own experience that I think illustrate this process of remembering. And before I do, just a word about triggering. I'm sure you all have your own grounding techniques. And one of the things that I use very strongly in my work is trying to avoid visualizing what I'm hearing. So I stay focused on my client's face and the words, but I don't let my brain go into imagining it. So as we're going through this, if that's a helpful suggestion, I hope you will use it. I said this was the triggering level of 5 or 6. I had no, I wasn't sure what to do, but I think this is fairly moderate. The first is about my early childhood experience of sexual abuse and how I remembered 40 years later. And so there's going to be a couple triggering things, maybe right up close, up front here. January 12, 2014. For the first time in my life, I say aloud the words, I was raped. It's not that I hadn't thought it before, but there was always an internal argument about whether it was true. Putting it into spoken words makes it more real. And sharing the words with someone makes it really real. So I say to Jared. That's my message. We've been watching the episode of Downton Abbey in which Anna is raped by the valet of the house guest. Everyone in the house is upstairs listening to an opera performance. Anna goes down to the kitchen to get something to drink, and the valet, who's been flirting with her a lot, follows her and tells her he thinks she's missing something in her marriage. When she rebuffs him, he assaults her violently, and her screams for help aren't heard. I managed to sit through the last 15 minutes of the episode with my emotions in check. Then I know I have two choices. Stuff it or process it. And if processing is going to happen, the sooner the better. So I look over at Jerry and say, you know that the 5-year-old inside me doesn't like rape scenes. He nods, and then my emotions erupt. In the course of the next few minutes between sobs, I say, I just hate it. I can't believe it still happens. You don't see it coming. I should have walked out. But you don't see it coming. It's always like that. It is always like that, caught off guard just when you need to be protecting yourself. But it's not that I didn't see it coming. When the guy appeared in the door of the kitchen, I knew there would be some attempt to engage Anna in a sexual encounter. Yet part of me was hoping she would successfully resist. And that part of me won out over the part that was getting scared. Then it got violent very suddenly, and I was too paralyzed to move. After Jerry held my hand for a few minutes and I was calm enough to stand up, I got some tea and went to my favorite recliner and a warm comforter. I started thinking about why, after 20 years of recovery, I still can't stay detached enough to remember that it isn't happening now. I do that all the time in my work. I listen to accounts of rape and other trauma. I know how to protect myself from vicarious traumatization. Surely someday I'm going to get to the place where I won't be overwhelmed by a dramatization. My ponderings about this failure to be perfectly recovered are interrupted by another part of my brain saying, the reason you don't like rape scenes is because you were raped. I know that's not funny, but almost immediately the internal argument ensues. Is what happened to me really rape? It was oral penetration. It wasn't anal or vaginal. And I can't even remember if he ejaculated. Or can I? Just a month before, I had sat in my dentist chair with my regular, from my regular cleaning, and once again made sure that I had control of the saliva pump, so that I could quickly remove the saliva pump in my throat. I was doing a very good job not having any anxiety. I started reflecting on how many years it took to learn that this is all I had to do to feel okay in the dentist chair. Slowly, another insight settled in. If the thing that has made me hate going to the dentist for 50 years is the saliva in the back of my throat, it is likely the result of some experience with unwanted liquid being there. Again, I thought this before, but in the context of the Downton Abbey scene, it seemed real for the first time. Okay, I was right. I say it to myself for practice. But the full implications of the awareness don't kick in until Jerry comes back, sits beside me, and I repeat the words to him. The reason I don't like rape scenes is because I was raped. For the second time that evening, the emotions hit me in a wave of terror and grief. Finally, after 20 years, I had said the words aloud. I first remembered the scene that indicated that my uncle had sexually molested me back in early 1994. I had wondered about the possibility for several years before that. I had been attending 12-step groups focused on sexuality, and during a weekend retreat of one of the groups, I found Renee Fredrickson's book on repressed memories and started reading it. And following her suggestions, I made lists of all the places that had often caused me to have experience sexual arousal. I could match all of them to similar places in my childhood. A grove of trees on a farmstead like the one on the farm I lived in my childhood, work benches in basement like the one in my grandparents' house, 18-wheelers with a sleeping compartment behind the driver's seat like the moving van that came to move us from Iowa to Michigan when I was 5. So I tried Renee's suggestion of drawing a picture of one of the places. The workbench was easy. It was clearly etched in my memory. I looked at it for many times over the decades. Handmade of rough planks brought from the farm when my grandparents retired to town. It was covered with tools worn with use and littered with random tin cans and nuts and bolts. And then just to the left, there was the casement window up high in the ceiling, near the ceiling, where the afternoon sun streamed in and caught the particles of dust floating in the air in the otherwise dimly lit space. The shafts of light stood out against the beams above, a unique pattern of cross bracing. I'd always been fascinated by that pattern and the lines of sunshine streaming down from the window. So I drew all this, and as I drew, my attention turned next to the empty space between the workbench and the screens of light. And my brain knew instantly what needed to be there. A small boy lying on his back on the concrete floor with a large man straddling his body. But when I tried to draw it, my hand wouldn't move. I was stunned. Slowly I realized the logic of what was happening. It made sense that I would be fascinated by the floor beams above me and the specks of dust in the sunlight if I were lying on my back looking up at them and trying not to be aware of what was happening to my body. It was reasonable that after what had happened, I would associate sexual arousal with workbenches and basements. And the fact that I couldn't draw the picture was even stronger evidence that something emotionally overwhelming had happened then. I put the drawing aside and went back to my routine of work and study. I was then in the throes of my first year of clinical training. About a week later, it became clear. March 29, 1994. Almost 20 years ago this month. It's a cold, rainy morning. I'm close to the end of my 75-mile drive on the Maryland Turnpike to my internship at a VA hospital in Perry Point, Maryland. And I've been musing about the drawing and whether it is accurate. Suddenly, terror explodes inside me, that old terror I've been chasing for more than 3 years, since one of my first really good therapists suggested that the sexual images I had told him I started having when I was 6 might be evidence of sexual abuse. And I felt the terror back then. I managed to pull off the road to a safe place and let the feelings wash over me. It took me an hour to get the last 4 miles to my office. Later that day, I wrote a draft of a letter describing what had happened and saying I believed I was molested by my uncle. A few weeks later, I sent it to my parents, siblings, and cousin, hoping to get engaged in the conversation. Mostly, the letter was met by silence, but it had started the process. To this day, my drawing remains uncompleted, but it set me on the journey of finding other pieces of memory, a search that has continued for 2 decades. And today I'm convinced that the picture I tried to draw is an accurate representation of what happened. I waited many years for a more complete memory, a video, a snapshot, but I've come to accept that I will never have that kind of memory. I'm okay with that. I now have no doubts that over 60 years ago, when I was about five years old, on a sunny afternoon in my grandparents' basement, I was sexually assaulted by my uncle. I have enough pieces of the puzzle. They fit together too well to be coincidence. The emotional valence of all the parts, the visual memory of the place, the drawing I made of it, the gag response in his endless chair, the terror I experienced watching the scene on television, all match up. I do not need objective, corroborating witnesses to believe my own memory. The emotional release I experience when I finally accept and speak the truth inside me is confirmation enough. Okay, that's first. I just want to give a minute for questions about how that. About how that demonstrates the recovery, memory recovery process, at least in one example.
Can you say a little bit about the sexual arousal place of the bench?
I just have sexual thoughts. You know.
So that's the same as like maybe if you have fantasies of children being sexually abused when you were abused as a child.
Yeah.
Even though it seems crazy.
Yeah.
Then why is it?
Well, in my mind, from my brain, it's because what happened to me next to a workbench in a basement. So that was, Freud called these things screen memories. The brain remembers something, and behind it is hidden the real memory. So a workbench is the screen memory. Behind it is the real memory of what happened there.
But it's like attached to a sexual feeling. Like those sexual feelings? And then it doesn't work because
it's a trauma
pairing, isn't it? Trauma
pairing? Trauma pairing would be a good way of doing
that.
Yeah. The brain, the synapse connects workbench to sexual arousal, or some, you know, sexuality in general, but doesn't connect further to the exact experience of what happened there. That's where the break is. The
so
disjunction.
It might have been pleasurable for you back.
Oh, no, no. I was terrified.
Oh,
that's
but
it
can be both, too.
Right.
Well, I was too pre-adolescent. I was 4 or 5 years old. I was not...
Even that can be.
It can be, but no. Not with this uncle. It would not have been pleasurable. I did not like having things stuck in my mouth. Okay. Helpful. Now, I think we have time for the second one. I hope so. I may have to cut this off, but it was a little bit more complicated. Because this gets into my experience of ritual abuse, and this is called The Binding of Isaac, which refers to the biblical story about Isaac and Abraham and his son Isaac. So that's the core of what I experienced. April 8th, 1994. Some 10 days after the other breakthrough. It all came in a big rush in the spring of 94. I was in school, finally feeling safe enough. Once again, I'm on the Maryland Turnpike, this time headed home on a sunny Friday afternoon, looking forward to the weekend, to get to my internship in the VA hospital from the internship to my home in the Washington suburbs. I have to go through one of 2 tunnels under the Baltimore Harbor. The new one, the Fort McHenry Tunnel, is sleek and bright, 4 lanes each way. You can drive 30 to 80 miles an hour if there's no traffic, but it's often backed up at rush hour. So today I choose the Baltimore Harbor Tunnel, only 2 lanes wide and much narrower. I'm in luck, there's no backup, I breeze in. Halfway through, a wave of terror erupts in me, totally unexpectedly. I feel like I'm going to lose control of the car. I feel I have to grip the steering wheel tightly and focus on just doing nothing but driving. Making it back into the sun, outdoor sunlight, I clear the toll booths, pull off, and let the feeling sweep over me. The fear becomes centered on a visual image that is coming into focus in my brain. It is the interior of a farm machinery shed, a Quonset building with a curved roof line. It's dark, the only light is the flicker of firelight. I realize that the space, the shape of the harbor tunnel, the way it is lit by reddish-yellow arc lights spaced along the wall that create a strobe light as you drive through, could have triggered the image I'm seeing. But I have no idea where it is and why I am there in my memory. But this is my first intimation that there was ritual abuse. As soon as I am calm enough to drive again, I finish the drive to Silver Spring, but I cannot shake the picture in my mind. The closer I get to the safety of home, the stronger it gets, but I do not want to go to my apartment since I'm living in a basement sublet, the cheapest place I could find while I was in grad school. I need a place where I can release the terror without scaring my landlady. So a block from home, I see the parking lot behind a big neighborhood church. I pull in, there's a quiet spot in the corner where no one will see me. This afternoon sun is warm, I lean back and the image comes into focus again. Terror gets stronger and then the picture changes. I feel like I'm being held down on my back on some kind of platform. In my visual memory, I see a knife, a hand holding a knife poised over my body, the knife pointed at my heart. No matter how hard I try, I cannot give any more detail, just lots of terror. I pull out my journal and record what has happened. Once again, I recover my equilibrium enough to go home, get a good night's rest, and go hiking with friends the next day. One of the parts of the remembering process that often amazes me is how I can have intense flashes of memory that are overwhelming, emotionally draining, followed by days of return to routine and the ability to function. There's a compartmentalization that goes on in our brains that can be very effective in shutting down memories that are too terrible to dwell on, while allowing another part of the brain to take over and run daily life. I've come to know that this is a form of dissociation, but I didn't know it back then. I was just mystified. Following that Friday afternoon in the Harbor Tunnel, there was at least a week during which I puzzled over why I could not identify what I was remembering. There were many Quonset sheds on farms in Iowa, but none that I could place in my childhood memory. I was also very confused about who would have taken me to that place and subjected me to whatever was going on. Then one morning a week later, I was going through my desk looking for something. I opened a drawer and came upon an old pocket watch that had belonged to the uncle who had abused me. Since he was long dead, it was something of a family keepsake that one of his sisters had. She'd given it to me several years earlier at my request when I was starting to get intimations that he was not a benevolent figure in my childhood, but it was still unclear what had happened. And I just wanted to keep it around to see if it helped me remember. This time it did. As soon as my hand touched the watch, I knew exactly where the Quonset shed was located. It was on a remote piece of farmland that my grandfather had acquired and provided for my uncle to work. It was an isolated place, cut off from the view of other farmsteads, perfect place for gathering. I had one conscious memory of being there in my teenage years. By then, my uncle was in a psychiatric hospital, and the rest of the family was taking care of the property. And one of our summer trips back to the family hometown, I helped other members of the family go out to paint the wooden corn crib on the property. That was all the only buildings there were grain storage bins and a Quonset shed for machineries. No farmhouse. I have an uncanny memory for places. So the layout of the buildings was vivid in my mind from that teenage experience. I sketched it out. Then I asked my parents, who would be back there on a visit in a few weeks, to go to the place and take pictures. The pictures arrived 7 weeks later. They matched my drawings exactly. In the ensuing weeks, more memories emerged and all the pieces of the puzzle matched. The only possible conclusion was that at some point in my childhood I had been taken there on several occasions, and these occasions were gathering some kind of cult that abused children. By the time I was putting these pieces of the puzzle together, I had found Ruth, a good therapist who was exactly what I needed. we did a lot of hypnotherapy. I'm going to start fast-forwarding here. I felt like I was being transported to another universe that I'd only heard about. Prior to that, I'd known one person who had reported ritual abuse. I just visited that friend here in the Bay Area for 2 days before coming here. So I had a personal connection. It was terrifying, because I had no doubt that what I was remembering had happened to me. The unanswered question was, who had taken me to the gathering of the call? The logical answer was my uncle. Since I already knew he was an abuser, and he was connected to the place. But it's hard to imagine that my parents would have allowed him to take me away from them, particularly in the night or early morning hours, which is when my memories told me I was there. At one point in the therapy session, I was reporting that I was seeing people with masks and robes. My therapist asked me if I could remove the mask so I could see their faces. I was struck speechless with the thought that emerged. When I found my voice again, all I could say was, no, I'm afraid I would see my father's face. But I couldn't make my mind do that, remove the mask. So this just remained conjecture in my mind. It was too scary a thought to really believe. How is it that one part of the brain knows something that another part refuses to acknowledge? This wasn't the first time the thought that my father was involved had occurred to me. Back in the fall of 1990, when I told my first therapist, Paul, about having peculiar sexual images at age 6, he said that it might be an indication of sexual abuse. I found myself blurting out, if it happened, it was either my uncle or my father. That was totally just happened. Here I was, 3.5 years later, having more intimations that my father was involved, but still not being sure. At the same time, I also had evidence that fed my doubts about his involvement. About 4 or 5 months after the onslaught of memories in the spring of 94, I went to Michigan for a week and spent a couple hours a day talking to my parents about what I was remembering. And I was also watching them for any indication that they would know something about this. Nothing. Only later did I come to understand that anything that they knew about what had happened to me was probably also dissociated. There followed 3.5 years during which I continued my recovery work, including working with a therapist who did EMDR. In that process, I achieved a degree of desensitization to memories and could look at them with some detachment, but the mystery of how I was connected to the cult of abuse remained. Then, once again, the connection emerged without warning. November 1997, 3.5 years later, after I did these memories. It's a Monday morning after Thanksgiving. I returned the night before from a week-long trip, taking my oldest son to visit colleges in New England and visiting friends in New Jersey, where I'd previously lived. I awake just as it is getting light, and the first thought in my mind is, this would be a lot easier if you just accepted the fact that your father was involved. Period. That was it. No new memory, nothing to confirm that this was true, just a clear certainty that it was a fact. And in the next days and weeks, I watched as once again all the pieces of the puzzle rearrange themselves in my mind. I'm going to skip some of this. It's about all those pieces of the puzzle. And I realized that it's the only thing that could make sense of. I did a lot of work on it in therapy. I came to terms with it. I came to understand that my father probably had complete dissociation for whatever involvement he had in the cult. So I want to finish the story because it's about how my relationship with my father unfolded after that. After that late November epiphany, I only saw my father twice before his death. My son was graduating from high school and he wanted them to be there, so they came for a few days. I mostly kept my emotional distance, but I decided to use the visit to tell them that I was changing my name rather than giving them the news by letter. It was the evening of the graduation. After dinner, when my son went out with friends, I seized the moment and charged into what I had to tell them. It went badly. Surprise, surprise. And one of the interesting things about that, every person I know has changed their names as a survivor of ritual abuse. It just seems to be what we do, don't we? My mother was very teary and retired to the her room. My father stayed around to settle things, as he often did. I told him I needed to change because the old name reminded me of a little boy who had lots of sad memories. He seemed to understand and said he would try to explain it to my mom. They headed home to Michigan the next day without bringing it up. There, a week or so later, I got a letter from him accusing me of betraying the family. It was the last gambit in his lifelong struggle for control of my life. He'd always been something of a control freak, which is another reason why I believe the rigid structure of a cult might have captured his allegiance in his early years. He tried to shape my religious beliefs, was very upset when I started thinking for myself. He and my mother never affirmed my decision to embrace being gay, all of which I understood to some level and come to accept, but thinking it wasn't okay to choose a name by which I was known, that was too much. I burned the letter. I didn't visit him again for the next year and a half, even when he broke his leg and was flat on his back in traction for 10 weeks. Don't make the connections between his broken leg and mine. I haven't forgotten all of them. I went when he was on his deathbed, having suffered a stroke that left him without voice. He could no longer tell me what was wrong with me or how I should live differently. And I was able to be there without anger or recrimination because I had done the hard work of remembering and healing. I could see clearly how it all fit together, and I had made peace with it. Will I ever get absolute confirmation from an outside source that what I have remembered is accurate? No. Does it matter? No. I have made my peace with the fragment puzzle of memory. When I step back and look at all the parts that I've assembled, there's no doubt what the whole picture contains and that it is accurate. And I've learned from my experience that the payoff for doing the hard work of remembering, no matter how painful the memories, is a life at peace with the past. The journey is worth it. I hope the same for all of you. Thank you.